we have failed to meet nature's deadline. In the next few years, the world will be experiencing progressively more ominous and destabilizing changes.
If you go back into the glacial period, you see very sudden shifts. You can see shifts of 5 or 10 degrees in the temperatures of that region changing in a few years.
I wrote a novel that took place in a post-petroleum America.
We're talking about fundamental shifts in the way that the world is going to work over the next 20 to 30 years.
What does it mean that a car company in India is bringing out the $2,500 car? A slow sense of panic drifts into first world gas stations. At the pump, it dawns on the dullest consumer we have to share the dwindling supply of oil and the right to dump our carbon exhaust into an overloaded common atmosphere. And there isn't enough to go around of each for much longer. I'm Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock. Back in 2005, I said it was time to panic. 2005. Birds disappearing. Large ocean species dying off. Biggest storms ever recorded. Second hottest year on record. Polar ice cap melting. Oceans turning acidic. You know, it's almost time to...
panic!
Well, here it comes. This show we have 4 big-name guests. Author James Howard Kunstler gives us a quick glimpse of suburbia in an exclusive EcoShock interview. We'll hear Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ross Gelbspan tell a crowd it's just too late. The climate has turned, and all we can do is scramble to adapt. And some of the 9/11 truth crowd have dropped their suspicion of global warming, as we'll hear from conspiracy author Nafiz Ahmed. But first, another EcoShock exclusive with one of the world's top climate scientists. Dr. Mike McCracken of the Climate Institute in Washington, D.C., has edited a new book called Sudden and Disruptive Climate Change. New science points to a very bumpy ride down here on the Earth's skin for all the creatures. I want to squeeze all that in for you, so let's get going with our first interview. Michael McCracken is the chief scientist for the Climate Institute in Washington, D.C. He's a past president of the International Association of Meteorology and Atmospheric Sciences. He's also an editor of a new book called Sudden and Disruptive Climate Change, Exploring the Real Risks and How We Can Avoid Them. We're pleased to have Dr. McCracken with us today. Hello, Mike.
Hello there.
Well, with all the strange weather changes and melting ice, this new book should interest a lot of people. Can you begin by telling us, what is abrupt climate change?
Well, the general perception has been that the climate will sort of gradually shift as the concentration of CO2 rises in the atmosphere. But I think what we're finding is, and if you look at the historical record, the Earth's history, you see the potential for rather sudden changes, for it to change in jumps and starts. The Earth's sort of a finite size, the wave patterns of the atmospheric circulation can go one way around a mountain, or gradually they can shift and go another way around. And so you end up getting shifts or surprisingly rapid changes. And we're trying to point out that that's much more possible than it's been considered in the past.
Well, I do remember learning about climate change in the late 1980s, and the problem then, as many people expressed it, was that things would change so slowly and regularly that humans wouldn't take it seriously. So how did that model of slow, incremental climate change start to break down?
Well, one thing that happened was they went drilling some ice cores in Greenland, looking back at the climates of the past. And what they found was, although there have been relatively slow shifts over sort of recent centuries, not too far back, but if you go back into the glacial period, you see very sudden shifts. You can see shifts of 5 or 10 degrees in the temperatures of that region changing in a few years. that's apparently a result of large-scale changes in the ocean circulation. You sort of think of the ocean as a large inertial thing that you couldn't possibly change, but it turns out that it's very delicately balanced by forming enough cold water in the high latitudes that it will sink, and that will pull some salt, warmer water up from lower latitudes. And if you don't get cold enough and you don't get dense enough, then it doesn't sink, and you can change the atmospheric circulation where currents go. I mean, ocean circulation, and then change where currents go, and that changes the atmospheric circulation.
And we're just learning that that may be happening now in West Antarctica.
Well, we're learning also that these ice sheets are not as stable as we think. They're starting to move much more rapidly than had been thought. The models that had existed, the observations had shown them sort of moving slowly. Now they're starting to change much more rapidly. And that's surprising everybody. And that's occurring both in Greenland and in the Antarctic.
Can you describe the new book for us? Who are the contributors, for example?
Well, we invited experts in a number of different areas. What's, I think, unique about this book is that it tries to cover the full range from some of the scientific aspects to some of the impacts to what you can do about it with experts in each of those areas. So in the first area, Barry Pittock, who's a prominent scientist from Australia, talked about reasons why the present estimations by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change may be underestimating. That is, we're seeing some things that could be happening faster, and he starts pointing those out. Judy Curry, who's an expert on hurricanes and tropical cyclones, talks about how we're starting to see those change more rapidly than we had thought. So there's some elements of climate that are changing. We have a section on how the cryosphere is changing, on how sea ice and Greenland and the Antarctic are changing more rapidly. There's been a lot in the news about how Arctic sea ice is melting back more rapidly than anybody had expected. We're still trying to understand the mechanisms for that. And as I said, why Greenland and Antarctica are starting to change more rapidly than people thought. There's a section on what that will mean along the coast, because the rising sea level will come from warming of the oceans and from melting glaciers and ice sheets is going to cause sea level to go up. IPCC projects it sort of 1 to 2 feet over the 21st century, but that's without including some of the dynamics of the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets and if you could get more rapid change, and there's some indications of that. So there's papers talking about what could happen on the coast generally and then along some of the specific areas, the Gulf Coast, Chesapeake Bay, New York Harbor, and so experts sort of look at the various approaches that one can take. We were interested to hear Malcolm Bowman talk about the fact that New York is considering storm surge barriers, or he's proposing it for New York, because not just of sea level rise, but because they're tremendously vulnerable right now to a storm surge from a hurricane or from nor'easters into the harbor. The projected storm surge height, if it came in at high tide for Category 3 hurricane, is over 20 feet. Subways are protected to about 8 to 10 feet. There's already levees around LaGuardia from flooding in the 1950s. There's a lot of vulnerable areas. So our country is very vulnerable, and so is the world generally, to sea level rise. There's a section on what might happen to ecosystems and how the forests and the grasslands will change and how various of the species will change, like the polar bear. So that those first four sections can get a little discouraging, but we also then have this book about what we can do about them or what actions are being taken. And that's much more encouraging. There are some places that and groups that have just started to move. So President Grimson of Iceland talked about what Iceland is doing to try and get completely off of fossil fuels, not just the Kyoto 8 or 10%, but get completely off. There were talks about what the U.S. can do. There's talks about or papers about what industry is trying to do and how it's being successful in various ways. There's a call to action by written by Dan Wirth, who's from a sort of graduate student group that is trying to get students involved and really realizing how much change can be and make this our sort of new civil rights movement. There's a really interesting chapter put together from the panel of religious leaders of their perspectives, the different perspectives they have about the environment. An amazing similarity about responsibilities that we all need to take on for that. So there's a lot of things that can be done. So the book sort of goes over the whole gamut of kinds of issues, talking about what can be done, gets only a little into some of the policy aspects, because people can actually make a difference if we get to work at it.
Well, I could see a possibility of abrupt social change to match this kind of a problem, and I'm glad to hear that your book covers that as well as some of the scarier aspects. I'm wondering if you could place this book in the context of a couple of other reports. For example, the U.S. Geological Survey has been working on something they call Abrupt Climate Change Synthesis and Assessment Product 3.4. I don't think that's been released yet, but you were a reviewer. How does your book relate to that report?
Well, that's a book that looks much more closely at the details of the science of what's happened in the past and the abrupt changes. The idea is to basically gain some insight from what has happened in the past and how fast things have changed in the past to get a sense of what could happen in the future. That's useful. The challenge is that the future is unlike conditions that the Earth has experienced hasn't occurred in sort of tens of millions of years or so. And at that point, it sort of occurred gradually. And so we're doing in a couple of hundred years what it took the Earth sort of tens of millions of years to come the other way. And so there's a real concern that there are going to be thresholds out there. We hope to get a sense of that by looking at the past, but you can't be assured that you'll find all of them.
Well, that's sort of one of the problems of the way humans think, is we operate from the past. That's the way our brains seem to work. And if we have something so unusual that it's never been seen in history, well, then we're, I think, a little bit stumped by it. Two is the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their reports. They already admit that it's a couple of years out of date. How does your new book work with the IPCC view of things?
Well, we sort of recognize the IPCC. The IPCC went through an excellent process, but as you indicate, because it's very carefully done, they do end up being a bit out of date. The particular area they're out of date on that I think is of most concern and was came up a lot in their review process had to do with the potential for future sea level rise and what would happen with respect to Greenland and Antarctica and their contributions. IPCC has to rely on papers that are already published and have been through a review process. That's the way they try and keep from getting swayed too rapidly by sort of cutting edge science. And so some of the latest results that have come out for Greenland and Antarctica from the new satellites that are measuring change in mass and from some of the new observations about that, and some of the reanalysis of the rates of ocean rise in the past that have looked at changes in instruments and their contribution to sea level rise. Some of those haven't been able to be considered, and if you look at those results, they're sort of pushing us toward looking toward the problem being more severe than IPCC generally has thought. And in fact, if you look at the sequence of IPCC reports, each one that has come out has sort of come to find that the newer findings show the changes happening a bit more rapidly and a bit more intensely than the earlier volumes were suggesting. That's happening with respect to CO2 emissions. They're going up faster than even some of the high emission scenarios that IPCC has had because of all the growth of coal-fired power plants in China and India, and are continuing in action. We're still building plants as well. So that you're getting higher emissions, concentrations are going up faster, temperatures are continuing to go up, sea level is going up right now at a rate that's about twice the average for the 20th century. So there's a lot going on. IPCC doesn't get to some of the new issues. We didn't so much either on what could happen if you start melting permafrost and methane comes out. So there's sort of feedbacks out there in the future that could lead to greater change. That was why, as I say, Barry Pittock's paper is sort of the first one in there about 10 reasons why IPCC may be underestimating what's happening.
Good. Well, we're talking with Dr. Mike McCracken of the Climate Institute about the new book, Sudden and Disruptive Climate Change, published by EarthScan. Mike, you must meet people who think this is just another end-time scenario blown up by scientists or greens or something. How do you handle that?
Well, in fact, I was, just when you called, responding to one of those comments that was coming in. Well, I think what is so important to understand about what has gone on and the efforts to understand this issue is the scientific community has put together a process that's tried to very carefully and cautiously look at this information. IPCC is not a process that should be known as representing the views of 2,000 scientists or how many ever authors and reviewers are involved. The key thing about IPCC is the very careful process it goes through. It gets a group of key authors on particular issues. It gets them to write a draft. That draft goes out to experts for review. That comes in for revisions. I was a review editor this time watching over the process. The comments are typically twice as long as the chapters themselves each time. So there's a lot of comments coming in. They then go through those and revise their chapter. They go through the process basically three times. On the chapters, they do a sort of two times around process.
So a lot of very intelligent men have taken every possible step to double check the information.
Well, that's right. So they're looking very carefully. They're very cautious. They try not to draw conclusions when there's a range of views out there, and they try to understand what the range of views are. And many of the skeptics who are criticizing offer and submit their comments, and those are carefully considered, and you try and understand, has that been addressed before, and how should it be addressed? So it's a process that's very careful. It ends up being endorsed by most of the academies of science of the world and by professional societies. It's a very cautious, careful process. It gets unanimous agreement by the countries of the world, 150-plus countries that participate. You can't call it a cutting-edge green document about, you know, worst-case kind of things. What should be disturbing to everyone is that such a careful process is getting findings that are talking about so much change.
Well, what have we missed here? Is there a key point that you'd really like to leave in the minds of our listeners?
Well, I think it's very important, on the one hand, to find out about the science, to recognize that climate change is occurring, and then to be thinking about how that will affect them and how to adapt to it. If you can know about something in advance or have a good sense of it, most people are able to figure out ways to adapt so they'll moderate the worst kinds of impacts. So adaptation is something that everybody's going to have to do. Our book talks about some of that along coastlines and in other ways to try and adapt to the kinds of changes that are occurring. The second aspect of this issue, of course, is trying to limit how much is going to occur in the future. That's a choice we have to make. It's a choice we make for our children and grandchildren. I thought it was very interesting at our session and in the foreword to our book, John Ashton, who's the UK ambassador at large, basically says that this issue has so many impacts and will have such consequences for the Earth that we can no longer consider it a simple cost-benefit issue. We have to consider it a national and international security issue, which means we really do have to face up to addressing this issue. It will cause so many impacts of such diverse kinds that it will basically destabilize societies around the world, and that's very important and will affect all of us.
It's really true. You know, the big picture goes all the way from the effects on bugs and insect reproduction
right up to the top levels of our economy, and somehow we have to bring out this holistic picture.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at health impacts, well, we looked at, for the U.S., we looked at the consequences for the U.S., and one of the things we realized as we were going through is we were looking locally and not recognizing how interconnected the world is. But we can't just be worried about diseases here in our protection system. People here travel all over the world. People from all over the world come here. Diseases move. Whatever happens in one place will start affecting others. And we sort of see this with some of the talk of SARS and some of the other diseases. That's true for the economy as well. The international economy is all connected. So what happens in one place will affect others. IPCC sort of talks about, oh, this is going to be most difficult for developing countries because they don't have the resources to adapt as well as we can. But in developed countries, we have so much located right on coastal regions. We're going to have troubles too, and our investments and the things we purchase come from elsewhere in the world. So we're a very interconnected world, and this is going to be a very challenging issue.
You've been listening to one of the world's top experts on rapid climate change, Dr. Michael McCracken. He's the chief scientist of the Climate Institute in Washington, D.C. You can find them at climate.org. He's an editor of a new book, Sudden and Disruptive Climate Change, and it's published by EarthScan. Thank you so much for your time today, Mike.
You're very welcome.
To find out more about the new book, Sudden and Disruptive Climate Change, go to www.earthscan.co.uk. That's earthscan.co.uk. And don't forget the Climate Institute, founded with a lot of foresight way back in 1986. Getting in there first, they got the most basic web address. It's simply climate.org. I'm a big fan of our next guest. James Howard Kunstler is the author of more than a dozen books, including his searing criticism of suburbia called The Geography of Nowhere. His ideas on city design in the coming era of oil depletion, climate change, and other emergencies are taken very seriously by university planning schools. In the fourth week of January, Kunstler will be giving two lectures to the Simon Fraser University Urban Studies Program and a special talk for a Vancouver Community Association. We'll give you all the connections to Jim's funny and frightening weekly blog and all the info to tune into Kunstlerville right after this exclusive EcoShock interview. James Howard Kunstler is the author of The Geography of Nowhere and, more recently, The Long Emergency. He's a longtime critic of suburbia and our oil-based life. Hello, Jim.
Hi, nice to be here.
In your 2008 forecast, you talk about a society exquisitely rigged for implosion. What do you make of the tipsy financial dance? Have the pirates finally sunk the good ship of consumerism?
Well, I don't think they've sunk the consumerism ship. That's really more an ideology than a behavior. And there's going to be quite a hangover in the ideology department, I think, for quite a while in terms of our expectations. But it does seem that there's an awful lot of money being wrung out of the system, and that we're going to see a whole lot less spending for quite a ways into the future.
I ask about that financial debacle because we have so much expensive stuff yet ahead of us as oil becomes scarce and more expensive and the climate shifts. In a fall interview with the editor of the University Bookman, you characterized climate change as, quote, the flip side of the resource problem. How do you relate global warming and peak oil as realities and as public movements?
Well, there's clearly a connection between the amount of fossil fuel that we burn and the amount of carbon dioxide that we dump into the atmosphere. You know, it's really pretty self-evident. And so, you know, it's another factor that is going to compel us to change our behavior one way or the other.
And you predict a massive rearrangement of public life? Is there really much potential for planning? Do we have much choice or power over what's happening now?
There's a lot of delusional thinking about what we can do and what we're able to do. And I think a lot of misplaced hopes in technology's ability to rescue us from especially from the oil problem. But I think we're going to be disappointed with what alternative energy systems and schemes can do for us. And I think the bottom line is that we cannot run the kind of happy motoring utopias that we are accustomed to on any combination of alternative fuels. And what that means is, you know, we're going to have to stop expecting that the interstate highway system and Walmart are going to run on hybrids or ethanol or biodiesel. You know, the answer is we're really going to have to rearrange the way we do commerce and the way we get around. And these things are, you know, they imply some pretty severe changes, but they're not necessarily impossible tasks for us. Unfortunately, a lot of this redounds to the question of our previous investments. You know, we've got such an enormous investment in big box stores, for example, that it's going to be very hard for us to understand that we have to really give it up. It just isn't going to work. It isn't going to scale for us, and it's just too darn bad. So we're going to have to rebuild those local networks of, you know, regional trade and local retail that were destroyed systematically by the big box stores. And, you know, once again, it's not a matter of whether we like it or not, or it's a matter of circumstances coming down on us that are going to compel us to behave differently.
Along those lines, you have cited Dmitry Orlov's new book, Reinventing Collapse, The Lessons from the Dissolution of the Soviet Union. Do you really think the Russians were better prepared for trouble than we are now?
Well, they were better prepared for certain elements of it. As Dmitry says, the Russians were producing about 90% of their food from their home gardens. And so when the collective industrialized agriculture of the Soviet system fully collapsed, you know, and it was in partial collapse well before the Soviet system as a whole collapsed. In fact, collectivized agriculture only barely worked through the whole history of the Soviet Union. It was always a sort of a failure, which is why the gardens, you know, had been established for such a long time. But, you know, as Dmitry also points out, the Soviet government owned all the housing in that country, and so when the system collapsed, people weren't thrown out of their homes. They just basically stayed in state-owned apartments until slowly adjustments were made in the system and things tended to get privatized and so on. So, you know, here we're facing some very different conditions.
On the positive side, here in British Columbia, the government has announced its largest ever multi-billion-dollar spending program with lots of public transit, including light rail that's going to go out to suburbia. So do you think things can improve where leaders exist?
Well, it's a good start. I'm not that optimistic about suburbia really maintaining its value and its usefulness under any circumstances, but, you know, you'll never persuade the public. The investments we've already made in suburbia are already so enormous that I'm afraid that what we're going to see is a campaign to sustain the unsustainable that will go far beyond the issue of, you know, putting a few light rail lines in. And I think this may be the big issue for the decade ahead is how much of our remaining resources we expend or squander on trying to prop up a system that really doesn't have a future.
We'll be right back with our interview with James Howard Kunstler in 30 seconds. Let's get back to our interview with author and urban critic, James Howard Kunstler. Well, you're a regular speaker at public planning conferences and courses. What kind of advice do you give these urban planners?
Well, a few things that are counterintuitive to the conventional received wisdom of the time. One is that I think a lot of the expectations about how we're going to inhabit the landscape will not turn out to be consistent with reality. For example, I don't think that our cities are just going to fill up with people moving in from the suburbs. In fact, I think our big cities face problems that are equally daunting, but different, of course, from the problems that suburbia faces. What I think we'll see instead is a real demographic shift, a real reversal of the 200-year trend of people moving from the country and the small towns to the big cities. A lot of this is going to happen because it will become much more important for us to grow food close to where we live, which means that wherever we live, there's going to probably have to be some meaningful relationship with an agricultural hinterland of some kind. I also think that the scale of our existing gigantic metroplexes, including Vancouver, the scale of these things is not going to be consistent with our resources going further into the 21st century, and it will be the smaller towns and the smaller cities that are more likely to be successful. I think the process of downscaling our big cities is going to be pretty painful and probably pretty disorderly.
Those who follow your nonfiction works may not realize you also have a half dozen fiction works. Can you tell us about your new one coming out soon?
Well, actually, this is my 10th novel. And after I finished The Long Emergency, I really wanted to graphically depict the kind of world that I was describing in The Long Emergency. So I wrote a novel that took place in a post-petroleum America. And it's set in upstate New York, a decade or two in the future. I don't want to be too specific about it. And an awful lot of things have changed, a whole lot. The electricity is not running very well. In fact, it's pretty much flickering out. There are no more cars running, and people are living pretty close to the bone. So on the other hand, you know, there are elements of this world that are actually rather appealing. A lot of the terrible, incessant background noise of our lives that we're so accustomed to, you know, between being bombarded by advertising and having the engines roaring in our ears all the time, a lot of those things are gone in this world. It's a much more tranquil and serene kind of world that's being depicted here. But it's real different. And the characters are faced with the kinds of situations that, you know, that are not like the kinds of things that happen to us.
And what's the title of the new book again?
The book is, this novel about post-oil America is called World Made by Hand. It's published by the Atlantic Monthly Press and coming out in March.
I'll look forward to that, and I really want to thank you for taking the time for speaking with us, James Howard Kunstler.
You're welcome, Alex.
Here is how you can get tuned into James Howard Kunstler, and that's spelled K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R. His main website is just kunstler.com. Dig around for his Eyesore of the Month series. It's photos of the most stupid building designs in America. Then read his weekly blog, The Cluster Beep Nation Chronicle. Fill in the bleep. It's hilarious while educational. Kunstler is a real writer with a biting sense of irony and humor as he dissects the strange fantasies of America. Lately, he's covered the collapse of the American economy, served up straight, without any media spin or trans fats. The blog comes out every Monday. James Kunstler will be giving 3 speeches in Vancouver, Canada next week. The first is a closed session for the Urban Studies program at Simon Fraser University on the 21st. He follows with a speech to the Vancouver Community Association, and then his public speech is on January 24th at 7 p.m. with free admission. Hear James Howard Kunstler, January 24th, at the SFU WASC Center for Dialogue, 580 West Hastings Street, Vancouver at 7 p.m. The topic? The long emergency is Vancouver's problem, too. Radio EcoShock will be there. You can find a listing of his many upcoming public appearances at Kunstler.com. One of the reasons Jim Kunstler says suburbia is doomed is their total dependence on oil and the car culture. Peak oil used to be banished to web bloggers, but the Wall Street Journal for January 17, 2007 carries this little headline, "Slower oil field decline is seen." It's a late admission that world oil fields just can't deliver anymore, no matter what lame duck president leans on his Arab buddies. Perhaps even another fake war can't solve this one. According to the writer Neil King Jr., quote, output from the world's existing oil fields is declining at a rate of about 4.5% a year, meaning oil producers will have to find new production of 3.8 million barrels a day this year just to stay even. That is roughly the daily output of Iran, the world's fourth largest producer, end quote. A new study by the Cambridge Energy Associates manages to stay positive anyway, saying we'll find all the new oil we need somewhere. The Wall Street Journal says, quote, some of the biggest fields in the North Sea, Alaska, and the Gulf of Mexico are declining at rates approaching 18% a year, end quote. The new study suggests that by 2017, the world will produce approximately 33 million barrels less than they do today. But our current world demand of 85 million barrels a day, all we can squeeze out, I might add, might hit 112 million barrels a day by 2017. That's just less than 10 years away. In other words, people will be lining up to buy a product that isn't there. If you are concerned about peak oil, and you should be, here are two of my favorite sites. GlobalPublicMedia.com has the latest relocalization and peak oil TV and radio shows. That's free at GlobalPublicMedia.com. People who want to dive into the hard facts of oil production and oil shortages should go to TheOilDrum.com. That's all one word, www.TheOilDrum.com, for daily news and discussions about peak oil. This is Radio EcoShock, and I'm your host, Alex Smith.
Thanks to the Hollywood Enviro scientific cabal and a certain failed presidential candidate with way too much time on his hands, more and more Americans believe that global warming is a cold, hard fact.
We've heard from scientist Mike McCracken that Earth could experience sudden and disruptive climate change. Then urban critic James Howard Kunstler told us our cities aren't ready to cope with the long emergency that is developing. Now it seems that climate-induced panic is indeed setting in. We're going to hear dire warnings from two more speakers, Ross Gelbspan and Nafees Ahmed. Like Sir James Lovelock in Britain, these are people who have embraced climate despair. It is already too late, they say. It is time to prepare for the worst. Personally, I still think there is time to limit the damage. This is no time to give up on environmentalism and emissions reduction. I'm not ready for ultimate pessimism, but those voices are growing, and you may want to hear what they say. When it comes to climate, seasoned journalist Ross Gelbspan says we are past the point of no return. In an article published in both Grist and Common Dreams online magazines, December 12, 2007, Gelbspan says, it's too late to stop climate change, so what do we do now? The article was the text of this speech delivered in December 2007. Here is Ross Gelbspan.
Start with the activists. Virtually all the national and grassroots climate groups are pushing hard to reduce carbon emissions. The most aggressive are working to change America's entire energy structure from one based on coal and oil to a new energy future based on non-carbon technologies, as they should. But even assuming the wildest imaginable success of their initiatives, let's say that tomorrow humanity began to replace its coal and oil with non-carbon energy sources, it would still be too late to avert major climate disruptions. Al Gore's work in bringing the climate crisis to public attention won him a well-deserved Nobel Prize. But Gore, like many activists, continued to peddle the notion that we can solve this problem. We can't. We have failed to meet nature's deadline. In the next few years, the world will be experiencing progressively more ominous and destabilizing changes. These will happen either incrementally or in sudden, abrupt jumps. But under either scenario, it seems inevitable we will soon be confronted by crop failures, water shortages, increasing damages from extreme weather events, and potentially by a series of breakdowns in our civic lives. In the face of this reality, the Step It Up campaign, which last year mounted 1,400 protests in 50 states, is hoping for an even bigger impact this year. The Campus Climate Challenge, with its 500 chapters, is planning a new and more energetic clean energy campaign. Another group, Focus the Nation, is persuading colleges and universities around the country to green their campuses. And the large Washington-based environmental groups are fighting over which piece of inadequate climate legislation to support in the Senate. A lot of these people are my friends, so I don't mean to say that what they're doing is wrong, but they're addressing only one part of the coming reality. And they kind of recall the kind of frenzied scrambling that's characteristic of trauma victims, a frantic focus on other issues, any other issues, that allows people to avoid the central take-home message of the trauma. In this case, the awesome power of inflamed nature. Within the last 2 years, a number of leading scientists, Rajendra Pachauri, who's head of the IPCC, British ecologist James Lovelock, and Jim Hansen, have all declared that humanity has already passed or is about to pass a tipping point in terms of global warming. Using its very conservative scientific language, the IPCC recently declared that it's very unlikely that we will avoid an era of, quote, dangerous climate change. Far more likely, according to the scientists, is that we will experience a series of, quote, abrupt and irreversible changes. In fact, we may already be witnessing the early stages of runaway change and the melting of the Arctic, the increases in storm intensity, the accelerating extinctions of species, and the prolonged nature of recurring droughts. Many scientists, moreover, are afraid that warming is taking on its own momentum, driven by internal feedbacks that are now independent of the amount of carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere. Given this reality, or even the possibility of this reality, I think the hollow optimism of the environmental establishment is diverting us from focusing on the survival requirements of the human enterprise. I want to give you just a couple of examples from current science right now. A rise of 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial temperatures is now virtually inevitable. Despite growing public awareness of global warming, the world's carbon emissions are rising 3 times faster today than they were in the 1990s. As a result, many scientists tell us that the official sanction forecasts of coming changes are significantly understating the real threat facing the world. Scientists are predicting a steady rise in temperature beginning in about 2 years, with half the years between 2009 and 2019 surpassing those of 1998, which is right now the hottest year on record. Given the unexpected speed with which Antarctica is melting, coupled with the increasing melt rates in the Arctic and Greenland, the rate of sea level rise has doubled. Scientists recently raised their prediction of ocean rise later in the century from 3 feet to 6 feet. Scientists discovered that a recent unexplained surge of greenhouse gases escaping from the same trees, plants, and soils that traditionally absorb these gases. In the lingo of climate scientists, carbon sinks are turning into carbon sources. Because the added warmth is making vegetation less able to absorb our carbon emissions, scientists expect the rate of warming to jump substantially in the coming years. The intensity of hurricanes around the world has doubled in the last decade. During that time, we have seen twice the number of Category 5 hurricanes than in any other 10-year period on record. The last of these items I want to mention happens to involve Australia. In Australia, a new permanent state of drought in the country's breadbasket has cut crop yields by 31% in the last 2 years. This one-in-a-thousand-year drought exemplifies the little-known impact of climate change. It's an interesting one, I find. As the atmosphere warms, it tightens the vortex of the winds that swirl around the poles, and these winds become stronger, and they actually retract as they become stronger. And one result is that the water that traditionally evaporated from the Southern Ocean and rained down over New South Wales, over southeastern Australia, is now being pulled back into Antarctica, drying out the southeastern part of Australia and contributing to the buildup of glaciers in the Antarctic, which is the only area on the planet where the glaciers are actually growing. This warming-driven crop devastation has also led to a tragic increase in suicides among Australian farmers. Among scientists, I think the panic is expressing itself in several extremely dubious geoengineering proposals put forth by normally sober and respected scientists, which would basically allow us to continue burning coal and oil. Nobel laureate Paul Crutzen, for example, is one of the several scientists who proposed spraying aerosols into the upper atmosphere to reduce the amount of sunlight hitting Earth. Unfortunately, the seeding of the atmosphere with sun-reflecting particles would trigger a global drought, according to other researchers. And they point out that this happened in 1991 when Mount Pinatubo erupted and we had a bunch of heat-reflecting aerosols put up in the atmosphere. That was followed by a significant drop in rainfall and a record decrease in freshwater runoff into the oceans. James Lovelock, the British ecologist, recently proposed installing deep water pipes on the ocean floors to pump cold water to the surface so that it would enhance the ocean's ability to absorb carbon dioxide. Others are suggesting that we dump iron filings into the ocean to increase the growth of algae, which in turn would absorb more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Neither of these proposals remotely considers the possibility of other impacts on ocean dynamics or marine ecosystems. What these scientists are really offering are technological expressions of their own desperation. Parenthetically, I think what they're proposing also amounts to a full employment act for companies like Halliburton and Bechtel, but that's sort of beside the point. But in trying to geoengineer our way around nature's roadblock, they're failing to acknowledge their own ignorance about unintended consequences. And almost inevitably, when we tamper with nature in ways we don't understand, nature comes back to bite us in the backside. To be fair, the reality that faces us all is extremely difficult to deal with, as much from an existential point of view as from a scientific one. Climate change won't kill all of us, but it will dramatically reduce the human population through the spread of infectious disease, the collapse of agriculture in traditional fertile areas, and the increasing scarcity of drinking water. Witness the 1-in-100-year drought in the southeastern U.S., which decimated drinking water supplies in Atlanta and other southeastern cities. These problems will be dramatically intensified by an influx of environmental refugees whose homelands can no longer provide viable living conditions. Last spring, the U.S. Army War College declared that climate change is a top national security issue and that it will lead to geopolitical instability in ways that will impact American military operations around the globe. An increasingly inflamed climate will also put our tradition of democracy, corrupted as it already is, at even further risk. When governments are confronted by breakdowns, they are forced to resort to totalitarian measures in order to keep order in the face of chaos. And since carbon dioxide, as I said, stays up there for 100 years, it is not hard to imagine a short-term state of emergency morphing into a long-term state of siege. So one frequently overlooked potential casualty of accelerating climate change may be the democratic process itself. Add the escalating squeeze on our oil supplies, which could intensify our meanest instincts, and you have the ingredients for a long period of repression and conflict. Ominously, this plays into a scenario which was very thoughtfully explored by Naomi Klein, that the community of multinational corporations will seize on these coming catastrophes to elbow aside governments as agencies of rescue and reconstruction, but only for communities that can afford to pay. This dark vision implies the increasing insulation of the world's wealthy minority from the rest of humanity, buying protection for their fortress communities from the Halliburtons, Kiewits, Bechtels, and Blackwaters of the world, while the majority of the world's poor are left to scramble for survival among the ruins. In other words, a new era of corporate totalitarianism.
You have been listening to the award-winning journalist Ross Gelbspan saying we are beyond the point of no return on climate change. The text of this speech, which was published in both Grist and Common Dreams, can be found on his website, www.heatisonline.org. A lot of new faces and movements are joining the climate crusade. It's been disappointing to hear battlers like radio hosts Alec Jones and Webster Tarpley deny human-induced climate change. They say it's all a plot to bring on a fascist global government.
When you find out modern environmentalism is neo-feudalism and a way to control resources and one-child policies they're now admitting under the program and under the carbon taxes that's now being announced.
But the younger generation is more clued in. One hot 9/11 truther is speaking out about the threat of global warming. Well, finally, instead of denials, we hear an expert from the 9/11 and terrorism crowd speak about the imposing threat of climate change. This is an excerpt from a speech given by Nafees Ahmed Mosaddegh at Imperial College, London, November 20, 2007. The title was The Hidden Holocaust, Our Civilizational Crisis. The first half of the speech talked of the death toll of colonial imperialism throughout the world, up to and including Iraq. In the second part, Nafees looked at the developing world crisis due to several factors, including climate change, peak oil, food shortages, and dying species. The full text of this speech can be found at his blog, nafees.blogspot.com, and that's spelled nafeez.blogspot.com. You can hear the whole thing in pieces on YouTube, or downloaded free from Radio EcoShock in the climate pages at www.ecoshock.org. It's 2 hours long. Nafees Ahmed is the author of The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked, September 11, 2001, Behind the War on Terror, Western Secret Strategy and the Struggle for Iraq, published in 2003, The War on Truth, 9/11, Disinformation, and the Anatomy of Terrorism, published in 2005, and finally, The London Bombings, an Independent Inquiry, published by Duckworth in 2006. Here is what he had to say about climate.
So where are we going to go at these current rates? And according to the UN's International Panel on Climate Change, they came up with a rather conservative set of predictions earlier this year for what might happen at current rates of emissions. And what they said was that if we carry on at current rates of emissions, global average temperature will probably rise to about 6.4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. In which case, this planet will not be livable, not just for human beings, but for any species, for plant life, for anything. It just won't happen. Now, to be honest with you, when I actually heard this, I was completely shocked. I really couldn't believe it. And this is why I keep going on about this, because when you kind of compare the gravity of this kind of statement with the way that the British government, for example, is handling the issue, it doesn't make any sense. In October, earlier this month, John V. Dow in The Guardian reported that Gordon Brown is now turning around quietly, I mean this was actually leaked from secret documents, was turning around of all his public pronouncements on climate targets. The aim was essentially to kind of reduce CO2 emissions to at least 60%. And they don't even want to do that. They quietly decided that they're not going to do it. So it really makes you wonder what's happening out there. According to Tom Burke, who used to advise the government, he was the British government advisor on biodiversity for quite a few years, he said that the 2 degree mark is almost already destined. We've already gone too far. What he said is that basically the minimum amount of CO2 in the atmosphere at 2 degrees is supposed to be 400 parts per million. Now, according to Keith Shine, who's a meteorologist at the University of Reading, he said about to study how much CO2 they actually have. And what he found was that, unnoticed by scientific and physical communities, it's risen beyond the 400 ppm mark. It's now 425 parts per million. And again, so that means that the 2-degree threshold is almost already here. Now, what does that mean? We're talking about fundamental shifts in the way that the world is going to work over the next 20 to 30 years. According to the US National Center for Atmospheric Research, already between 1970 and 2000, 10 to 15% of the Earth was experiencing unprecedented rates of drying as a result of global warming. Now what's happening is that because global warming is not just melting the Arctic, it's also melting the glaciers that feed the Asia's largest rivers. Now, the glaciers are basically a natural storage system. And what happens is they release water kind of normally during hot periods, periodically. Now, the shrinking ice sheets means that it's going to aggravate water imbalances, which is going to cause flooding as the melting accelerates. This is going to mean that there's going to be a reduction in river flows, and as a result of that, there will be less water around. And the impact is going to basically be on the developing countries mostly, but we are also going to be affected. You can see the figures there, they speak for themselves. What this means is that agriculture will just grind to a halt. People will not be able to grow food. Millions of people will not have access to water, they will not have access to food.
That was an excerpt from a speech by Nafiz Ahmed Mosaddegh at Imperial College London, November 20th, 2007. The title was "The Hidden Holocaust, Our Civilizational Crisis." The full speech is available in several parts on YouTube or as a download from the climate pages of ecoshock.org. While I think it is time to panic, to embrace big changes in our way of life, I don't think we can just party till extinction comes. As we learned in a recent EcoShock show, there may be no limit to climate change. Every ton of greenhouse gases kept out of the atmosphere could make a difference, and so can you. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Next week, we'll interview a top IPCC scientist about the new Greenpeace report on agriculture. Greenpeace and farming? Yep, it turns out that the meat on our table is helping to heat up the world. Let's get together next week to talk about it all. It's definitely time to panic! This has been news from Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org.
Civilization. Now what do we do?
Well, we'll probably continue to mutate. Then our very molecules will more than likely begin to break up. I'm sure our atoms will disperse slowly throughout the universe. I guess it's hopeless.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.com. .org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. We'll go out this week with a little bit from singer-songwriter Dan Bergen, Power from Above.
Sinners, are you ready for a little redemption? To receive forgiveness for what we've done? The time has come to break bad habits. It's time to turn to the wind and sun. Just a little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. There's a better way than barrels of oil. There's a better way than lumps of coal. There's a better way to work together. Renewable power, that's our goal.
That's our goal.
Just a little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home.
may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. What will we do for a better world? Get on your knees to hope and pray. Well, that's not enough.